You are listening to Investing Matters, brought to you in association with London South East. This is the show that provides informative, educational, and entertaining content from the world of investing. We do not give advice, so please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to this Investing Matters podcast. My name is Peter Higgins. You can find me at Conquest3 on Twitter. And on the eve of International Women's Day, I feel truly blessed to be speaking to the women's diversity, inclusivity champion, Alexandra McGuigan, CEO and founder of Inclusive Asset Management. Alexandra, welcome to the Investing Matters podcast.
Thank you for having me. I'm thrilled to be here. I actually had a very nice dinner last night to celebrate International Women's Day, so it's wonderful to also be here talking about these issues with you on the eve of the big day.
Thank you very much. I'm going to start with giving people a little bit of a synopsis of you, and then we'll get into your backstory, if I may. But this is just phenomenal. I need to read all this out for it to make sense to people, how much you've crammed in into your, I think, very, very, you know, limited years already. So Alexandra McGuigan is the CEO and founder of Inclusive Asset Management. Prior to that, Alexandra was the Global Development Director for 100 Women in Finance and was responsible for all the business development and corporate engagement. A sales and marketing strategist with a specialization in alternative investments, Alexandra was successfully helped international fund managers navigate and develop a presence in the APAC region, raising over $2.5 billion in assets under management for institutional investors. Based in Singapore, which is where you are today, Alexandra, thank you. You've basically been responsible for organizations and activities across the region, and you've also helped and held senior roles at Tribeca Partners, Shadow Enterprises, Investec, BNP Mellon. The list goes on and on here, including GAM, Oxif, Diamond Asset Advisors. You've crammed in so, so much. But I want to start, if I may, this conversation, Alexandra, with you telling our audience about when you first studied at university and what your first job was, because it's an unusual start for most people.
My first job, which is that really, the one that I told you?
Wine, we're talking wine.
Oh, wine. I was going to say my first job was actually at Donut King, and I don't think I've ever eaten a donut since. But my first real job was in the wine industry. So my family actually has a long history of making wine in Australia, dating back into the 1850s when they first came over as immigrants to Australia. My dad grew up in the Hunter Valley, which is a wine region north of New South Wales. And all of my uncles and aunts and everyone in the family lives in that region mostly. I actually grew up in Sydney. My parents were doctors, but I found my way back into the wine industry. I had a wine blog for some period and I'm still very passionate about wine.
Fantastic. Now, I want to maybe ask you this question then. As to, you know, you said the family was in the wine industry. So I'm sure family members were saying, you know, it would be fantastic to have a lady leading this business for us. And who better to do it than Alexandra? So there must have been some push and pull there regarding the family going, you want to go and do what now?
Well, I was only 22, so they certainly weren't ready to let me lead the company. and my cousin Lisa is 15 years older than me, and she was very successful in the business and was running the marketing. So there was a senior woman running the business, but no, it was my first job out of university. I really enjoyed it, but I also going and working for the family business. you kind of want to make your own strides as well. And I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do. And so my father, who is a great mentor of mine, encouraged me to do an MBA so I could expand my... And it was... I did it when I was... I started when I was quite young, so 24. So I would say rather than... most people think that an MBA is executive education, etc. But what I would say was... What I did in the by starting at young was very foundational, and so doing it early meant that I almost had a leg up on when things happened or when events unfolded in my career in future. I'd already kind of seen it before, even though I was through textbooks and role plays and group prep things and stuff like that. It really helped me to navigate, and I would say. Get ahead faster, even though but when I came out of the MBA program, I was only 27 years old or something, so no one's going to give a managing director role to a 27-year-old. But it certainly changed my life doing the MBA.
Brilliant. So your first start in the asset management industry was with BNY Mellon Asset Management. Please can you tell us about that, going in there as a young, you know, professional female, the chance is dominated by men ordinarily.
Yeah.
Tell us about that start for you and your greatest learnings from that first one.
Yeah, so I wanted to travel. I knew that I wanted, I'd done a stint in my undergraduate degree at Cornell. So I'd done an exchange there and I found that international experience very fulfilling. And obviously it's a bit of an adventure, but learning in different environments and different cultures is definitely additive to your toolkit, I would say. And so I knew that I wanted to do that again. I also had really wanted to try and learn a language. Australia's kind of a difficult place to learn a language, probably easier now, but at the time... it is very English dominated, and unless you come from an environment where you're surrounded by a language, then it's very difficult to learn. So I knew that if I wanted to go and learn a language, I would have to go and live in a obviously a non-English speaking country and be surrounded by it. And so what I decided to do was try and do part of my studies overseas. And at the university that I was at University of Technology in Sydney, which is an absolutely amazing university. I can't give more credit to that university. They had a program, and so I could do a portion of the MBA as an exchange student in France. And so in doing that, I knew that I needed to sort of get some more money together, and I had an interest in finance. And so I just thought, look, I'm just going to try my luck and see if I can get a job in finance, even though I didn't really have the experience yet to do it. And so I was very fortunate to, I mean, it was just an entry-level job, office management kind of role. But I was very lucky to meet the man who was the CEO. Actually, at the time, it was Mellon Financial before the merger. But he was an American guy, and I think that because he saw that I'd been to Cornell, that was a good thing. And he said to me, look, you're overqualified for this job to start with, but if you do it and you do it really well, then I'll teach you how to run a business. And I was like, all right, let's do it. I mean, I had nothing to lose. And when I spoke to a lot of people about that to get advice whether or not I should take the job because it was an entry-level job, it was interesting because most people said, oh, don't do that. You'll get stuck in something that you don't want to do. If you don't not going into the actual job that you want to go into, then, you know, you won't ever make it anywhere. And the only two people who told me, if you get the opportunity to take that job, take it with both hands and work your butt off, were the dean of the MBA program at the university and my father. And so when I got offered the job, I took it, and it could not have been a better experience. So basically, I just got to shadow this very dynamic, very driven, ambitious individual who had been sent out from the UK to set up their business there. And so, you know, he used to joke about it that while I was doing my academic MBA at university at night time. I was getting an MBA in finance in the real industry working at that office, and I did. So that was a pivotal time, time for me where he really encouraged me to go and originally I'd wanted to study luxury brand management in Paris, but he convinced me that the luxury brand companies, they needed people that could also understand finance and economics, and I'd already studied enough of the marketing, so it would be a good idea to broaden out my skills, and that if I did that, then I would probably end up liking a job in finance anyway and working there. And so it actually kind of worked out that way, because when I studied that, I guess there's this imposter syndrome for women where, I don't know, at school I'd had a bad experience in maths, and I was actually very good at it and I'd liked it, but I had a bad experience with a teacher. And then that sort of took my path in a different direction and I'd lost my confidence in it. So when I studied those subjects at university, I realised that actually I was really good at it and I really enjoyed it. So it kind of took that a roundabout pathway to get me back into it. But once I started studying those subjects, I was like, actually, this is fascinating. I really like talking about this stuff. It's interesting subject matter. You get to talk to interesting people and it's about everything that's going on in the world. I just hadn't even been aware of it before. So definitely his guidance helped me to get on this path, and I've been grateful to be on it ever since.
Absolutely fantastic. I love the fact you just seized that first opportunity and just worked your way up and, you know, applied yourself and, you know, to use that term, grafted, you know, because a lot of people want the success but are not willing to put the work in and haven't got the work ethic. And you've absolutely done that. And from then on, you've, you know, Investec, Tribeca, you know, tell us a bit more about some of the other roles that you've surpassed.
Yeah, sure. So when I came back, so I spent 2009 I was working at BNY Mellon for 2 years, which was amazing. And then it was always the deal that I was going to go off and do the year in France. So I still did that. Learned French some time ago now, but I still achieved that additional educational element there, which is totally enriching. So learning another language, I would highly encourage people to do that, or at least spend time in another country, because it helps you to understand that people think differently. And if there's no direct translation for words, it means that it's not important to that culture or that society. And so having that understanding helps you to be to deal with different people from different backgrounds. It helps you to be more empathetic, I think. So that was the first thing. But I did the finance subjects and I decided that I wanted to sort of follow in his footsteps and go into institutional sales. And then I tried to, when I came back, it was beginning of 2010, and, you know, the financial crisis was still in full force, so there weren't really a huge amount of sales jobs going, and particularly for people with no real sales experience. So I kind of went, all right, well, I've got to get a job anyway. So I reached out to anybody and everybody that I knew in the industry and said, I'm looking for a job in finance. I've just finished my my MBA. I'm willing to do whatever. And I got my break at Investec. So I worked in the private bank at Investec in Australia. I worked in managing, working with a sort of a more senior partner, but the client portfolios of high net worth individuals, which was very interesting. And then that unit of the business got sold, and they said, look, you can either go with that business or you can stay with us because we really like you. And so at the time, the only role that was available was head of marketing in the retail business. So I did that and realized I definitely didn't want to be in retail. I wanted to be in institutional business. So while I was doing that and just getting experience and learning as much as I could and making as many contacts as I could, I still kept my feelers out there to try and find a role. And then eventually I'd interviewed for someone and I'd gotten to the almost the final round. I was the second candidate really, but I didn't get that job. And then, but I kept talking to this the CEO who'd hired someone else, And eventually, a couple of years later, he actually recommended me to someone else who was looking for a candidate. And so I got tapped on the shoulder to join Shed Enterprises, which is a third-party marketing firm. It is the oldest and probably one of the most respected in Australia. And because of the landscape of Australia and how far away it is, and it's sort of quite a clicky, and that would be a result of the lack of proximity as well. It's an environment where you need boots on the ground, but it's expensive to set up an office, right? So until a company fund manager from Europe or the US knows that they're going to have some kind of success in the region or that their strategy is of interest or whatever, then quite often these big international fund managers, they would use a third-party marketing firm to sort of establish a presence, sponsor some conferences, come to do some roadshows and everything. So that was an amazing experience as well. Like I've worked very hard, but I've also been very lucky. And so Shed Enterprises had some of the names that you rattled off there. They were some of the fund managers that we worked with. And so we were an alternative specialist. So we worked in infrastructure, private equity, active currency, hedge funds, and all of that kind of stuff. And so I ended up worked with OxIF. I worked with primarily with GAM, and we had great success with GAM on a number of their strategies. And then I also got to work on a really fun product called the Diamond Asset Advisors, which is still my favorite product that I worked on, because that was I learned a lot, obviously, about diamonds, which is an alternative asset in itself. But it was a very fun project, but they were trying to structure a private equity like deal with the diamond industry. Anyway, that almost got up. We didn't quite get it up, but it was certainly a fun project to work on.
I saw the little glint in your eye there, because you actually were able to actually live the bit that you wanted to live previously about working in the luxury end of the market when you're working with Diamond Asset Management. So you must have absolutely loved that during that time.
Yeah, it was fantastic. And actually that what they'd done was so the senior, well, the CEO of the business was he was the former CEO of ADVEC, which is a private equity fund of funds, a Swiss-based, very famous, very successful business. And he finished working there, and he had a personal interest in diamonds. And so he partnered up with someone who had worked for De Beers, and working from De Beers diamonds are quite a mining play. And so De Beers has that they have, they go from mines all the way to shopfront, and that's where you get the greatest value on the diamonds. You're pulling the diamond out of the ground, and then you're polishing it and taking it all the way. So actually understanding the supply chain of things like that was super interesting to learn about. But yes, you are absolutely right. I did get to go to the Harry Winston store I think it's New Bond Street, and I got to see all of the really precious big stones, which was a highlight, I have to say.
Amazing. Fantastic. Now, I want to talk, because in the middle of all of that, the bits that we've missed is your first investment foray, which wasn't stocks and shares, but I want to talk about that first, because you did that at a very, very early age, which was property. And then secondly, I want to talk about your then first investing foray into the stock market, if we can, because I don't want to go to the point that you're going to tell me that the first thing you bought was diamonds, but we want to start with the property.
No, definitely was not. I've never bought myself diamonds. No, I'm too sensible for
that's
that.
For your husband to do. You know that.
Absolutely. Although I like them, but no, I'm actually quite sensible and pragmatic, and be that good or bad. So yes, I bought myself my first apartment when I was 23. I quickly figured out that renting and sharing properties and everything was difficult and expensive. And at the time, this was before the financial crisis, so me with not earning very much money, I still managed to get a reasonably large loan. But I did buy, I mean, this is sort of saying how old I was, but I bought my first property for it was about $300,000, a one-bedroom apartment in the centre of Sydney in like 2000 and... I won't tell you what day it was, because then you'll know how old
they are. Australian dollars. But let's put it there. Australian dollars. Yeah.
Australian dollars. But it was the property markets in Australia have gone bonkers since then. But it was a very good discipline, I think, because, well, quite quickly I learnt that I hadn't quite done my numbers so well, and I'd underestimated the amount of money that I needed to live on, and the interest rates and all of the other things that come along with that, and then also having to be responsible and calling. I mean, who do you call when your water heater breaks? You've got to find someone to fix it, and you've got to pay for that. So I think I grew up pretty quickly living in that apartment. But it was an excellent educational experience. And I mean, everybody talks about Rich Dad, Poor Dad. That book is genius, because the best way to sort of force yourself to save is to have something to put in. You can either have it automatically taken out of your bank account, or you can owe the bank the money and the bank will take it. So, and that's a bit scarier, I think, than having to save yourself. So that was a good discipline. And I never actually, because I did that, I never actually really had much money, excess money, right? And so I think that what can happen is if you don't do that early on, then you can start earning money, and then you increase your spending and you increase your habits and interests, and that's fine, but it's very hard to go back to a more limited life, if you will. People don't like to go backwards once they've already been forwards. So I kind of set myself up for success in doing that from the outset. And then And then I just did it again. I'd save some money, and I managed to get the deposit out of that property that I purchased very early on, and get the deposit for a new place when I came back in 2010. And so I've done that a few times. And if you can get property to a point where it's neutral, and you're earning, well, in Australia there are tax benefits to having property losses in property, so you can offset things like that. But if you can get it to a point that's about neutral, then you can just let it sit and go on the side, and then carry on your day, and you'll probably continue to earn a bit more money, and then you put that somewhere else. And so that's sort of been the trajectory that I went on. I'll stop there for a minute.
No, that's brilliant. No, it's really good to hear that. And the fact of learning the discipline of managing a property, because, you know, as when we're all younger, we think, oh, actually, it's just I'm just paying the rent and that's it. No. You've got gas, electric, all the other utilities mm-hmm. you've got to pay for, telephone, transport, food, got to feed yourself, you know, all those sort of things to encompass. Yeah. You know, and then you realise that all your friends are going out because they're living at home with their parents. You're staying at home because you've got no extra money to spend on leisure activities.
Well, back in that time, I think people were still renting a lot. So there weren't, I didn't have that many friends who were living at home. Whereas I think that there is coming to a point now where people just can't afford to live out of home, which is a little bit scary, because I think that this delay is like an extended adolescence, I suppose, where you don't have to look after yourself, which is not necessarily good for society. Having some self-maintenance skills that are useful, I would say.
Absolutely. Now, I wanted to ask you about your first foray into investing as well. Where did you start with regards to the stocks and shares? You know, you're in Australia, you're working with Investec, you're working with Shared, you're seeing all these different opportunities. When did you first go, actually, I'm going to invest in a stock?
Well, so I had, I've only ever had a limited share portfolio. So invested in some of the banks. Actually, I was kind of limited to what I could invest in. So when you work in a bank and you're in a role like that, you have to get permission and stuff like that. And to be honest, I didn't have much spare cash. What I decided to do is, in Australia, we have a thing called superannuation, which is it's the pension scheme. And so at the time, it was 9% of your salary gets taken automatically. But at BNY Mellon, they had this automatic top-up. So if you paid, if you forewent another 3% of your salary, then they would top it up to another, that they wouldn't match that. And so when I was there, I decided to also sacrifice that money to build up my superannuation quickly. And so everyone else was getting 9% and I was getting 15. And there's a wonderful thing called compounding interest. And so that serves its purpose over time. So I very early on, so I would say that more of my stock investments has been actually added to other to my superannuation, and then I would invest in the funds of the businesses that I knew very well and people that I knew and trusted. And to be honest, I was always surrounded by such amazing portfolio managers that I was like, well, I'm not going to go and pick a stock. I may as well give the money to them and get them Absolutely. To manage it, because, you know, what they're saying makes sense. And if I'm asking other people to do that, institutional investors, then I should also put my money where my mouth is as well. So I'm not really a portfolio manager. I'm more of an allocator, I would say, and I like to give money to people who, I mean, because I don't think that you can, I think there are some people who can beat the market, but not many. I'd prefer to have all my money in growth allocations in my superannuation. So I consolidated all of my superannuation, so put that all in one basket. So then you're building the largest pool, and that compounding interest then starts building on itself. Plus I salary sacrificed in order to get more than everybody else, I suppose. And then I quite deliberately, so you would normally have a balanced fund, and a balanced fund would probably be 60-40, so that would be 60% to equities and 40% to defensive fixed income and stuff like that. But it's, I mean, I've still got 25 years or so before I'm going to actually get any of that money. And when I was doing this, it was 50 years, right? So I was like, I can actually forego. I don't need to worry about the risk of markets crashing at this point, because I'm not concerned that I will have time to make it back. There's going to be several market cycles before I'm going to need to collect on this. And so I can put all my chips on the table and pay someone else who's much more talented than I am or was at that time to allocate that money for me. So I quite aggressively, I went 100% into equities in my pension, which is still what it is today. I might consider to change that in 10 years or so. But that's my equities allocation pretty much. And then also, I invested in the funds at GAM, and I invested in the funds at Tribeca.
Fantastic. And did very well. Fantastic. I love the fact that you just said, I went all in. I'm compounding. I'm going to be around for 50 years, so let's just go for it.
I hope so. I can't access it anyway. So even if I'm not around, hopefully the money will compound.
You'll be around. Yeah. So you've done the plan. You've looked at it. You've planned it. You've spoken with very, very smart people. Around you, you've looked at what's going on in the industry, and you're looking at the compounding effect that's potentially available to you, and you've gone, yeah, this is the way forward. So that's what we want to encourage people to do, to be more long term, you know, not in, out, and all the rest of it, trying to play the cycles, just compound.
Also, if the money is in somewhere that you can't touch, it's easier to be long term.
Absolutely.
Right? So if you're trying, and look, the tax benefits, I mean, I don't get taxed on that superannuation money, right? So it made, and I'm not a wealth manager or planner, but I just thought it made more sense to the money that I had to pay off the loan that I, yep. And put money into that, because I had a debt there, and then the money that was take away as much as possible, because you don't get taxed on that money that's taken into superannuation, right? So that minimizes my taxable income. And then with that money, put it as, it's as long term as possible. So then I've got property exposure. Then I have full equities exposure. I'm young enough that, you know, I don't need to be so defensive for the market cycles in that area. And then also getting a good cash balance, I think, is useful, because in the last couple of years, I've had a couple of kids, and, you know, we had to, life happens, and we weren't insured the way, because I didn't make the 12-month thing, and so we had to pay, right? So there are things that happen in life where you have to pay large chunks of money, and so having that available cash means that you don't have to try and pull money out of illiquid assets or scrimp and I don't know, get personal loans and stuff like that, which have a much higher interest rate. So that has been my strategy. And then my husband, he works in private equity. And so, again, that's another illiquid asset. So our plan is to... So all of those three are quite long-term. Even though the equities, there's a much greater return, but I can't touch that money. So with that, they're all long-term. So in the short term, I need a higher cash balance. And so that is what we prioritise.
Brilliant. I mean, you've almost answered this, but I'm going to ask you to expand on it. And I love this phrase that you've used here, and it intrigues me. Success is more about consistency than being smart, which I just absolutely love. Please expand to me what that means for you.
Well, I mean, if you're on a diet, it's not going to work if you just do it for 6 weeks. For example, I mean, a tangible example, right? You need to be consistent. Absolutely. And you need to make good choices every day. And that is an investment. Absolutely. In your health, right? And so you're not going to... I mean, I'm a chartered alternative investment analyst, which is a CAIA charter holder. Yep. So like a CFA, but for alternative investments. Even though I've been around a lot of cryptocurrencies and blockchain, I don't understand it, right? And so even though there's a lot of money that can be made, there is risk associated with that. So the risk you're taking, you are compensated with this high return. But I don't understand it, and I don't understand the market cycles or anything. So I just didn't invest in that. And so I lost the opportunity, but I also didn't lose my capital, which I could have easily done, trying to chase those high returns. And so I mean, you can do that with a portion of your money, but don't do it with... my personal philosophy is you can't invest things in trades like that more than you're willing to lose, because it is a bit of a casino, right? Whereas your steady investments that you're paying back your mortgage, you're adding to your pension, or you're adding to your savings to invest in a trading account if you're interested in companies and stocks and stuff, by all means. It's about how much time you have to do the research, though, right? And being efficient with your capital and working within whatever system you have to maximize your tax, which means that you have the largest amount of money to play with, and then working out what your long-term and short-term strategies are. So consistently thinking about it and tweaking it is the way to go, in my opinion. And I'm not going to get rich tomorrow, but little by little you keep advancing and you keep compounding on that.
Absolutely. I'm going to switch gears now, if I may, Alessandra. I want to talk about inclusive asset management. Okay. Amongst many things, it refers to the practice of recognizing injustices such as gender pay gap, implementing and hiring procedures that reduce the risk of unconscious bias. When and why did you set up inclusive asset management? Because it's probably the main reason why I'm speaking to you now, because of the amazing work that you've done previously that's led to this catalyst for you. So just share us a little bit of that journey and what led you to go, we need to make a difference here.
So I'd like to say it was as altruistic as it sounds, but it's not. I think it's just a good investment opportunity, quite frankly. But in all truth, I've always been involved in philanthropic causes. I was involved in Philanthropy Australia and went on a study tour with a group of young people to London and Geneva in 2015 to try and find my cause. But really what I found was that actually it's just gender equality. And I think that I thought I made a post today, but I don't think it actually went. But there, in Australia with the superannuation gap, there's women end up with 42% less superannuation than men because the system is based on a full life work cycle. And it doesn't take into account people who come in and out of the workforce. Now, they've made that change now to say that you get superannuation payments for parental leave. However, if in 1992, when the government of Australia was setting up this amazing system, and it is an amazing system, that has, you know, $3.5 trillion of assets for 26 million people. I mean, that's extraordinary. But if they had had women at the table when they set that up, then perhaps women wouldn't be that far behind, because the women would have said, well, hold on a second, I have to have kids, so what's going to happen when I'm on maternity leave? Or, and it's not, I'm not trying to give blame to anybody. What I'm saying is that better outcomes are created when you have diversity at the table, because more perspectives are considered, right? And you can come up with a solution that actually reflects the people in the society and not just one group of people. So that's the first thing. That is really the case in point for diversity at the board level, at government levels, and also in funds management levels. You will change outcomes for sure. Then within financial services, which is sort of my area of expertise, I set up my business when I moved to Singapore in 2018, and I consult to fund managers. Initially, I mean, they're mostly linked to sustainability outcomes, but as I said, gender equality is my personal interest. And I ended up working with a nonprofit called 100 Women in Finance, which is the largest nonprofit for women in financial services. And they have a vision to change the demographics of the industry and to get 30% female investment professionals by 2040. Now, the number is somewhere about, and I did a report on this, it's about 12%, and there's lots of other reports, but depending on what asset class you look at, it's between 10 and 12%. And that number seems to be consistent where for the last 30 years. So without some specific effort, you're not going to change that number. But there seems to be that 10% of women who, for whatever reason, choose this industry. And some people will leave and some people will join, but it seems to be consistently around 10%. And so that's a very small percentage of the number of investors out there. And so therefore, if you think about outperformance, I mean, it is much more difficult to succeed if you are a minority. If you are a woman in the room, if you're the young person in the room, if you're black, if you're Chinese, or whatever you are, if you are the minority in that room, even if it's a language barrier thing, it is much more difficult to succeed because everybody else is thinking in this is the way that things are done. And if you have different needs, it will be more difficult. So those 10% of women who succeed, I believe, and this is also likely true for managers from diverse backgrounds, minority backgrounds, but we don't have as much data on it. So I haven't done as much work on it. But my thesis is, if these women are underrepresented and they have succeeded to an institutional level, which is 3 years track record, $100 million assets under management and positive performance for 3 years, then they have succeeded against the odds. And in order to succeed against the odds, you have to be better than the mean. So if you filter and you try and find, you use a diverse filter, then you can find a subset of managers who have a greater chance of outperforming the market. And then if you use that to then pick the best ones, depending on what your mandate is, depending on if you want growth managers or if you want value managers or if you want quality manager, whatever you want, you can pick the best out of that category. And I just think that you are going to get a portfolio that is going to outperform. So that's why I set it up, because I think it's a good idea.
Absolutely. I mean, I've spoken with very numerous other managers before, female fund managers, and the research reiterates it over and over again that female investors and female fund managers will outperform their male counterparts. you know, and have done historically. The results are out there.
But I think it's important to qualify that and say it is not because they are women that they outperform, but rather they are exceptional people that you can identify, or exceptional investors that you can identify using a diverse filter at this point in time, because there's so few of them. So that's a very important point. In the future, if we have 30% or 50% women, then I don't think there would be any difference, because you would have some good women and some bad women, and some good male managers and some bad male managers. But at this point in time, you can use a filter to identify a group of people who have, in my opinion, have a greater possibility of outperforming the market. And that is what institutional investors should be looking for. They are looking for alpha.
Brilliant. Now, I've just grabbed a piece of research a few days ago, and in the UK, only 12% of the investment trust managers are female. This is according to the research from the Association of Investment Companies, the AIC, and this figure remains unchanged since 2022 and is in line with the global average of the funds industry, according to Citywide data. However, 41% of the investment trust directorships are held by women, up from 36 in March 2022. My dear friend Annabel Brodie-Smith, who is the communications director of the Association of Investment Companies, said, and this will chime with you, the investment trust industry has made great progress when it comes to gender diversity of the investment trust directors. Quotas and targets have helped at the boardroom level, with 41% of the investment trust directors now female. The industry is continuing to address ethnic and other forms of diversity on boards. But my question is this, Alexandra, in your view, what more needs to be done? Because there's still a lot of work to be done here.
Well, I think money talks, right? We actually have to get, I'm not talking about first-time fund managers or whatever. What I'm saying is that more institutional capital needs to go to high-performance female fund managers who meet all of these requirements. And if you're an institutional investor and you're looking, what I would like to see is that we create a database, and 100 Women in Finance is doing a good job of this. They have a database in a platform called Clade, and in that platform that they have women and diverse managers, etc. So you can search for those managers. But what I would love to see is that every mandate that is being given out, or where there is an RFP, etc., that diverse candidates have to be included in the lineup of people considered, right? If there is someone out there who fulfills the minimum criteria, then they have to have someone at least in the RFP process stage. Now, they may not be the best person for the job. They may not be. But if you're not considered, then you can't get the money. So I think that we have to hold ourselves to a higher standard in terms of that the money is managed by people who represent the people whose money it is. Right? It's your money.
Absolutely.
I want to have women managing my money because they understand that I think differently, or I care about things differently, or I don't know, I just think that they should do it. They're going to have different ideas, and it's probably going to mitigate some risks that the men are going to take. And it would be, this is not about one versus the other, one best. It is about representing the people whose money it is, with the best people possible, right? So you have the fiduciary responsibility to get the returns. That's the first thing, because if you're cold and hungry, then you don't really care if climate change is happening tomorrow. You want to make sure you have enough money for a blanket and some food, right? So that is the first and most important thing for the pension funds and for the sovereign wealth funds, to make sure that they have enough money to look after the people, right? But in order to get the most amount of money, then you would probably need to consider what the needs of those people are. And I think that we're coming to, here's my husband. He's peering in to see if we're still talking. He's waiting for his dinner. Sorry, I lost my train of thought. But we have to get to a point where we're actually making sure that the perspectives of all people are being considered. And I think that, we're getting to a good place of that. But one thing that I think would be an extremely helpful thing would be if they had that search criteria where if they could find somebody, and they should be able to find somebody because now we have these databases where women and minority fund managers are actually difficult to find. That is part of the problem, right? Whereas now if we're actually saying, well, there's a list of them, you know, at least make sure that if you're doing a credit mandate that you look on the diverse database list and see what credit managers are and if they meet your minimum criteria, then say include them in the RFP process. And if they're not, maybe give them some feedback as to why they're not or when they'll be ready. And so look, that's a lot probably to ask for people who are trying to manage money and do the RFPs and whatever. And that's probably a second step. But I think the first crucial step would be to have some kind of quota and some kind of accountability. You couldn't find them? Well, where did you look? Show me where you looked. And have that kind of due diligence or agreement where the board says, you know, prove it. Prove that you tried to find them. Because I tell you what, people say a lot of the time, I can't find any good women. Just come and talk to me. I know them all. If you look on my LinkedIn, they're all on my LinkedIn. So if you need a woman, just come to me. I'm the woman's woman.
Brilliant. I love that. I love that phrase. Now I'm just going to hammer this home a bit more, if I may. Because in 2020... the US Securities and Exchange Commission chief, Gary Gensler, said asset management industry is not doing a good job on diversity. Couldn't say it any bolder than that. Mm-hmm. What have been the improvements that you've seen regarding diversity and inclusivity across the asset management industry in the US, for instance, since that statement in 2020? Have there been some improvements? What have you seen? You know, who can you champion that's doing the works over there?
So look, there's some amazing people in the US. I don't spend a lot of time in the US personally, to be honest, but there is a group there called IADEI, Institutional Allocators for Diversity, Equity and Inclusion. They are an amazing group of people, a man named Rob Rabari and Stephanie Weston from the Rochester Endowment were two of the founders, and also Trinity Wall Street, Sophia Tsai, who I've had the pleasure of speaking with on a panel. They are part of this group that leads 400 institutional allocators who are really looking to put their money where their mouth is and to allocate to more diverse fund managers. So they, on the IDEA website, if you're a diverse manager, you can sign up to that and you can add all of your fund information. And they have pitches. So every second month they have a pitch and they invite, mostly it's private markets, but anybody can put their information in, I believe. And so that's the first thing. So getting all of the information in one place where institutions can then go and search for what they're looking for is key. Organisations like 100 Women in Finance are doing amazing things. There is a group called... Girls Are Invest Gain in the UK is a group, but then there's another group in the US. I can't remember the name off the top of my head. It's just escaped me for the moment. But it's a group that really is trying to build the next group of young female investors. So there's lots of different programs that are happening at different levels of the process. Now we need to build the pipeline, but we also need to get existing money to existing managers, because once that happens, then more women will actually stay in the industry, to be honest, because, you know, I mean, even if as much as I advocate for this, even sometimes I'm like, oh, maybe I should just give up, but then, well, you just can't, right? You've got to be consistent. You've got to go. Otherwise, what are you going to do? Can't do anything. So consistency is it. But there are some really, there have been a huge amount of changes in the last couple of years, certainly, with those organisations.
No, I love the fact that you've continued to actually push. And also, you've been a passionate advocate for upskilling and continuing your development. You speak various languages, you've done various different courses and all the rest of it. But I want to just, for the moment, just for you to share this wonderful journey that you had with Kaya and how that came about. And again, you just saw an opportunity going, I'm going to go for that, you know. And I think this is just an inspiring lesson for all women and others out there to go, never doubt yourself, always back yourself, you know, and go for it.
Yeah, so that was actually quite funny. I was at a conference, and David George, who was the CIO at the Future Fund, or the deputy CIO anyway, he was very senior at the Future Fund, which is Australia's sovereign wealth fund. And I knew he was the chapter executive for Kaya, and I'd kind of, I like studying and I like education, etc. So I said, oh, you know, I'm thinking of doing it. And he was like, oh, you should do it. You should do it. And I was like, oh, okay. All right. So I applied for a scholarship with 100 Women in Finance, and I won the scholarship. And I was like, oh, well, now I really have to do it. And then so I, I won the scholarship, so I had to do it. And so I did, and I just found it to be absolutely fascinating and the most relevant education that I'd ever had, because it was just so focused on exactly what I was doing. And so, I mean, I've had the great privilege of traveling with some just the most amazing portfolio managers, and, you know, spending time with people managing $18 billion and stuff like that, and sitting on planes and in taxis. And I mean, the education, and if you're curious and you ask questions, is quite exceptional. But the Kaya really filled in the gaps for me, and I'm still heavily involved. I'm a chapter executive in Singapore. I'm speaking at the university, one of the universities here, in a couple of weeks on sustainability and private markets, etc. So it's just the other thing. In order to your point about you can just do it, I actually years ago I stuffed up a presentation that I was doing, and I used to do acting and training and stuff like that, and I'd always prided myself on being quite a good public speaker, and I just completely bombed this presentation that I had to do. And after that, I was like, you're too cocky, you have to practice. And so after that, I made a decision that every time I was asked to speak, if I could do it, I had to say yes. Because, you know, some of the time there's only 10 people in the room, some of the time there's 20, but the more you practice and the more you get comfortable with being uncomfortable, the more confident you are, the more you start to learn about your narrative, what you want to talk about. So you're practicing all the time, right? And doing so in low stakes environments means that when you actually have to present at a big conference that your work wants you to present to or whatever, you have the confidence to speak with that. So that's another, I would say that you just got to go for it. And if you win the scholarship, you definitely have to do it. and if you tell someone like the CIO at the Future Fund that you're going to try to do it, then you better try. So you got to follow through, I would say. But certainly, and that's why we're talking today. Certainly, if someone gives you an opportunity to speak, then you almost certainly have to say yes, because that will help you to develop your skills. And I mean, at the moment, well, I mean, you're going to post this afterwards, but right now it's just you and me talking, so it's a nice environment.
You've done absolutely phenomenally well. I truly believe you're an amazing, articulate, intelligent, inspiring individual, Alexandra. So I think now is probably a really good time for us to talk about your achievements, what you're most proud of, and just, you know, in the fact that you're continuing to blaze the trail for diversity and inclusivity across the asset management industry. So just please share with us some of the recognitions and the gongs that you've got.
Well, I'm going to have to, I remember someone asking, I asked someone that question once in an interview, and I said, you know, what's your most proud achievement? And he said, being a father. And at the time I was like, oh, come on, that's so lame. But actually.
You get it now. You're a mother, you get it.
Yeah, I get it. And actually I'm a mother of two boys. And married to a very egalitarian Scandinavian man. And so teaching our children and boys that women work and that women are valued in the same way as boys, I think is probably my most important work. In terms of achievements, I obviously raising multiple billions of dollars is a huge achievement. I remember once I was, I set myself a goal to raise $1 billion for one of the fund managers. And at the time, I mean, I had really had no idea what that would have entailed. And someone was like, why would you do $1 billion? And I was like, well, it has so many zeros. Like, I don't even know how much money that is. It seems like a reasonable target. Why not? And so then I just kind of chipped away at it and I got there. And then the fund manager, this was actually quite funny. I went into the office in London for the first time and they introduced me as the $1 billion girl. And so that was quite the achievement, raising my first $1 billion. I mean, raising your first tickets at all is very exciting, but raising $1 billion and then multiples after that. But and then also championing the women's cause and helping to promote that. I mean, as I told you, I give my money to other female investors and other investors because I believe that they're excellent. And I think it's really good that it just would be the easiest trade in the world. Like institutional investors, they give a lot of money to do a lot of tricky stuff. Whereas if you could just find some highly skilled managers who continue to give you returns on a consistent basis, that should be what you're looking for. So come and talk to me.
Absolutely. IAM is where it's all happening. Now, I'm conscious I've had you on here for a little while and your husband's waiting for you. So I'm going to try and squeeze in two more questions, if I may.
Okay.
I'm a big believer in a person being true to their authentic self, which clearly you are, Alexandra, and not trying to conform to industry stereotypes in order to fit in or to be successful. Please, can you share with us one of your most non-conformist success stories that you've met or have seen in the asset management industry in recent years?
Are you leading me? Did I write something down? I'm not sure.
No, I'm saying there's lots of women out there doing some fantastic work, and you're traveling all around the world, and you've seen some of them that are doing stuff, and you've gone, actually, why hasn't that been done before? You know, actually, this is a really good piece of work. And every now and then you just sit back and go, you know, I need to speak to that lady.
Yeah, so, I mean, I don't know why I didn't even jump at that question immediately, because for the last 2.5 years I've been building a product called the Woman Fund for an institutional investor based in Singapore. And what we see as the main problem for female and probably diverse fund managers is that they have less network, so they get less money when they start. Right, so that makes it difficult for them to grow. And then if you have sub $100 million, you're not really considered institutional quality because these guys are so big and these guys are so small, right? So it's impossible for these guys to access the alpha of these guys, even though they're very good, because it costs them money eventually. There's a break-even point where they can say the minimum amount of money that I can invest to get value out of that investment is $100 million or $200 million. So what we see is that even though there's 10 or 12% female fund managers out there, it's 10 times more difficult for them to raise assets. So women and minority owned fund managers in the US, so it's not quite apples for apples, but they manage less than 1% of the total assets in the USA. Now, what the reason for that is, I don't think that it's all about unconscious bias necessarily, but they get filtered out of the allocation process because they are disproportionately in this emerging managers no man's land, let's call it, right? And so you can find in this area of the sub $500 million fund managers, you can find some very, very high quality managers that have the proven track records, that have good pedigree, that have low correlation to other strategies, all of these nice, wonderful things. But the only thing that makes them emerging is their assets under management, right? And so what you can do and what we've tried to develop is a vehicle to enable these guys to access the alpha of these guys. But rather than a fund of fund, which was sort of the historical way to do it, which people don't like because it's expensive, because it's illiquid, it's not transparent, all of this kind of stuff. What we've decided to do was create a fund of mandates. And so that is a vehicle where these guys can put money into a fund. They can put in their $200 million, $100 million, whatever they want to put in. And what we have is essentially six segregated managed accounts of female, high-performance female fund managers who manage a portion of that capital, but within this vehicle already. So the money is safe. It never leaves the custodied account. It's risk managed because there is an additional layer of trading pre and post trade compliance. It's cheap because we don't have to. We just have one fee for the fund that is shared between the underlying managers and this manager, and it's fully transparent and fully liquid. So I think that we've made something that is quite unique and quite amazing. It would be, as far as I know, the first fund in the world that has been created like this. There are institutional investors who have individual mandates like this, but they don't. There is not a fund vehicle as yet. So that's what I've been working on. It is the thing that other people have said to me, why hasn't anybody else done this? And I tell you, it's because it's been a lot of hard work. A lot of work to figure out how to do it. And what just took me like 2 minutes to articulate to you took 2 years to figure out, and how we would do it in a vehicle and legally, and then actually set it up. And it's been lawyers and administrators and tax people and all of the best of the best. And I have to say, the service providers that I've worked with are second to none. So that would be the unconventional thing. Sometimes it's hard to get people across the line with an idea, but this is, I mean, it was interesting. We didn't use any sustainability criteria to identify the underlying managers because we just wanted it to be about the financial returns. But actually, when we did, we used a group called Matter, an amazing Danish fintech. I would give them a plug as well. They did the analysis for us to do the sustainability work. And when we basically, you put the portfolio in and it spits out like a 150-page report. And I mean, when I went through it with the co-founder and COO, Emil, he was like, this is like quite incredible, because you usually have to give up one thing to get another, but the performance, and it is I have to say, it's a paper portfolio of the aggregated funds, but it is their real performance. Like, they have actually invested and made this money, but we aggregated it with their data. But it outperforms the market. It outperforms the MSCI World ESG index. And it outperforms on CO2 emissions and Sustainable Development Goal alignment. So not only does it seem that these fund managers outperform the market, but they do so more sustainably. So maybe if we invest with women, not only can we get better returns, but we can also save the world while we're doing it.
Fantastic. I love that story. My next question, I've got to add a question in there now, is when does it launch and how do I sign up?
Imminently. send inquiries this way. Send inquiries this way.
I most certainly will. Fantastic. No, you'll have to come back on. Once it's launched, story, it's been running for a year, you'll have to come back on and we'll have to do a talk about the fund, and obviously we'll have a name for it then by then as well to tell us about. No, really looking forward to hearing more about that.
And I will introduce you to all of my underlying managers, because they are all exceptional and they all do things in very different ways. So I'll give you some amazing female investors to talk to.
Brilliant. Thank you ever so much for that. Now, conscious of the time, so I'm going to ask you one final question, Alexandra. Thank you for indulging me with this. Right. So to all those female undergrads studying and considering a career in the asset management industry, what are your impassioned words and guidance to them on this eve of International Women's Day? Alexandra?
I think explore all at once. First of all, study maths. You have to keep studying maths because it will give you opportunity. And you don't have to do maths in your day-to-day job, but having those finance, economic skills, make sure you have a broad set of skills so you can really find out what what it is that you want to do with your life, because, you know, life's not fun if you're not enjoying your work, that's for sure. So I would definitely encourage that if you are interested in investing and knowing about different organizations. I can give a list to you, Peter, of different organizations in different regions that students might like to reach out to help them find opportunities, mentor opportunities, all of that kind of stuff. And I just say, just go for it. There's never been a better time to be a woman in finance, and there are infinite people looking for talented, hardworking individuals. So if you want to work hard and are interested in the field, then there is limitless opportunity for you.
Fantastic. I love the phrasing that you've put there for that. And I feel there's going to be another, Alexandra McGuigan take two in another 10, 15 years going, because I listened to that interview, I was inspired. So thank you ever so much for joining me today. Ladies and gentlemen, women's diversity, inclusivity champion, Alexandra McGuigan, the CEO and founder of Inclusive Asset Management, has been your guest on this podcast today. Thank you ever so much for joining me, Alexandra. Enjoy the rest of your week and a fantastic International Women's Day tomorrow. Thank you. Take
care.
Thank you so God much bless
for
you.
Having me. Okay. Bye.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to Investing Matters. Be sure to check out the London South East website for free tools and info to research your next investment. You can also join in the conversation on our social media channels. And don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel for more content, including our CEO interviews. Catch you next time.